Blog Talk Radio.
Here we are, this week. Happy anniversary to us. Apparently, Dr. Laura thinks the First Amendment means you have the right to say, ready, aim, fire at the N-words in a crowded theater. A taxi driver in New York City is in stable condition after being stabbed by a passenger who apparently asked if he was a Muslim before attacking him. Does anyone think this isn't related to the fomenting of hate by those supposedly opposed to the building of a mosque two blocks from Ground Zero? New jobless claims, after going up for 3 weeks in a row, went down last week, meeting our prediction. On the other hand, sales of new homes declined unexpectedly in July. It's an uneven recovery. We'll talk about a double dip. And people at risk for type 2 diabetes, according to a study in Japan, are more likely to have brain abnormalities associated with Alzheimer's. Been hearing about the liberal media? It's garbage. Foreclosures are down, new jobless claims are down, and consumer spending is up. What does the New York Times, a supposed bastion of liberality, headline? It says, foreclosures fall, but rise in delinquency causes concern. If there's a bias here, it's to look for bad news somewhere, and that doesn't help the supposedly liberal Democratic Party. Yesterday was the anniversary of the death of a famous U.S. senator. Care to guess who? 1, 2, 3. Okay, time's up. They say that as you get older, time seems to pass more quickly. It is actually a year since Ted Kennedy died. Besides that being a sad fact, if you liked him, it should also make you feel older. Glad I could help. And if you want to feel a little older, that cute little kid in Home Alone, he just turned 30. Okay, it would be bad news if you found out that your car had been recalled. But how would you feel if you found out the latest subject of a recall was your implanted hip? If yours was produced by Johnson & Johnson subsidiary, Dupuy Orthopedics, it could be your turn. At least you won't have a problem with sudden acceleration. And speaking of recalls, Garmin is recalling over 1 million GPS units. It seems their batteries can overheat and cause fires. And, of course, that probably means you shouldn't wear one on your hip. In Alaska, Republican incumbent Senator Lisa Murkowski is depending on absentee ballots to allow her to snatch victory in her primary election, which she, thus far, appears to be losing to Tea Party and Sarah Palin favorite Joe Miller. If absentee ballots work out their traditional way, she'll lose, even bigger than she's losing now. But absentee ballots have changed, and we'll try to explain that. The dollar hit a 15-year low against the yen. Good news or bad news? We talked about this a bit last week, and if we have time, we'll be glad to discuss it further, if you wish to hear it. Is this the kind of story for which you yen? Okay, probably not, but you'd probably hear it anyway. Ben Quayle won the Republican primary for a seat in the House of Representatives, in Arizona, of course. The good news is that 75% of Republican voters voting in the primary voted against him. The bad news, besides that he won, is that he'll probably win the general election. This is in a state, after all, that passed SB 1070 and has, in its most populated county, the man that's been described as either America's toughest or stupidest sheriff. By the way, young Ben seems to be blessed with the intelligence of his father and the charm of his mother. Mr. and Mrs. America and all the ships at sea, welcome to Speaking of Everything with Jeff Bushman. That would be me. All that, news of the weird, our guest, Larry Hancock, with more about the JFK assassination and the latest edition of his book. That is his, Larry's, not his. Well, you understand. Anyway, we'll have all that, plus this day in history if we have time before Larry joins us. And if you would like to join us, you may do so at the following phone number, 347 area code, 994-3796. As I say, if you'd like to join us either now or when Larry joins us, of course, feel free to do that. We will get you on as soon as we can. In any event, that's what's going on here. Let's talk about some of those stories. the taxi driver in New York, who in fact is a Muslim, was stabbed after acknowledging that fact, that is his religion, when the young man who is the suspect, allegedly, asked him. The suspect, by the way, is a college honor student. Now, honor doesn't mean what it used to, apparently, but apparently he was able to get good grades. We also mentioned in the beginning of the show the new jobless claims. This changes, obviously, from week to week. They're talking about weekly new jobless claims, which means people who are filing, requesting unemployment for the first time. So that went down, the number of new jobless claims, which is a good thing. And I mentioned before that the fact that it went down met our prediction. I didn't specifically predict that jobless claims would go down, new jobless claims would go down this week. What I did say is that after going up for 3 weeks in a row, it could easily go down the following week, or up and then down for 2 weeks, or up and down and up and down, because this is what's going to happen. Unemployment will always follow a full recovery, that is, a reduction in unemployment, will follow a reduction, a full recovery. And we don't have that yet, rather obviously. Once that does happen, unemployment will go down. So we have a ways to go. As to the double dip, now, when I was a lad, a double dip referred to two scoops of ice cream. Now it's referring to the possibility of an additional recession marked by a reduction in the gross domestic product. Right now, technically, we are not in a recession because we have had an increase in the GDP in the last quarter after having several quarters of reduced gross domestic product. We are going to probably have almost definitely have a positive GDP growth for the next quarter or two. So double dip happening soon is unlikely, but there are some economists who are talking about it being a distinct possibility. There are two kinds of economists who are talking about a double dip being possible. One is the conservative Republican economists who feel that if they can say bad things about the future of the economy, it will help Republican candidates. So please be aware when you hear economists suggest that may be where they're coming from. On the other hand, or the other side of the spectrum, you do have liberal Democratic economists like Paul Krugman, who's a great economist, winner of I believe it was the Nobel Prize in economics last year, who is talking about the possibility of a double. I don't know if he is specifically, but liberal economists sometimes are talking about the possibility of a double dip. That's because they want something, and I agree with them, that they're unlikely to get, and what they want is additional stimulus funding. I say they're unlikely to get it because the Republicans in the Senate would threaten the forbidden or frightening filibuster, frightening, that is, to the Democrats in the Senate, and they would therefore not get to vote on it, and that would not go anywhere. But those are the two camps. My own feeling is that we're not going to have a reduction in the GDP anytime in the near term or even medium term. The bad thing you can say about the economy, and this is my view, is that you will have slow growth in the gross domestic product. Well, that's not a recession. It's just a slow recovery, and again, an uneven one, up and down, at least certainly in terms of unemployment, housing, all of those things. So those are the things that are going to happen, and in my judgment. And you can judge how right I am as time goes by. But if I am wrong, people will point it out. If I'm right, no one will remember. The study that we talked about coming out of Japan is interesting. And to remind you, because your memory may be flawed since the beginning of the show, you may not remember, that people at risk for type 2 diabetes, those who have some signs of type 2 diabetes, such as increased blood sugar, show an increased propensity towards Alzheimer's. the difficulty with the study is that they can't yet tell if there's a cause and effect relationship between the higher blood sugar levels and the increased plaque in the brain. This is a type of protein that, there is a type of protein that causes the buildup of plaque in the brain, which is believed to be a sign of Alzheimer's. Realistically, the only way traditionally they've been able to tell if someone has Alzheimer's is by performing an autopsy on them and checking the brain. As a rule, these autopsies are done after death because otherwise it would be too cruel. But that's how you tell someone has Alzheimer's. There's no other way thus far to know that. In any event, the reason I mentioned that they haven't been able to tell whether there's a cause-effect relationship is people who are inclined towards type 2 diabetes tend to be the same kind of people who consume a diet, which is likely to cause deposits of fat in the arteries, and a high fat diet has been previously linked to Alzheimer's. And when you're talking about people who are eating garbage, then that's what's going to happen. So if you have type 2 diabetes and you're concerned about Alzheimer's, do what you can to get rid of the type 2 diabetes. That can include, but doesn't necessarily include, the utilization of pharmaceutical drugs. One of the things it does include is cleaning up your diet and maybe doing a little, dare I say it, exercise. Okay. Now, the news we talked about before, additionally, about Alaska, is at least academically interesting. The Republican incumbent there is named Lisa Murkowski, and she was running for her party's nomination or renomination to run for re-election. She is a Republican. And she's a moderately conservative, or perhaps just a conservative Republican. That wasn't conservative enough for Sarah Palin and the Tea Party types. So they put up this guy, or this guy was running who they supported, by the name of Joe Miller. As of our last reading, Joe Miller was ahead in the primary balloting by about 1,600 votes. There are, however, 15,000 approximately absentee ballots. So will that help Lisa Murkowski? We mentioned if absentee ballots work out their traditional way, she'll lose, but that absentee ballots have changed somewhat. Let me explain that a bit. Normally, absentee ballots traditionally have been much more conservative. That is, the voters who put in absentee ballots have been more conservative than those who show up at the polls. And there's a logical reason for that. In the old days, people who put in absentee ballots were people who were actually going to be absent from the state on election day. And those people, again, commonly, were traveling, were better off, and those who were better off tended towards being more conservative. And that is probably still true. That is, probably the absentee ballots will still skew more conservatively than the regular voters, the non-absentee voters. But in recent years, at least in many states, they don't call them absentee ballots anymore. They call them early voting ballots. And the reason for that is because of a court decision a number of years ago, you don't have to demonstrate or assert that you'll be absent on election day. You have the same right to put in your ballot early for later counting, as does someone who is in fact not going to be present. So as a result of that, many people who are not very well off and traveling and more conservative and so on and so forth are putting in early ballots, and therefore the voting patterns may turn out to be less conservative. Does that help Lisa Murkowski? Hard to know. The reality is that in order to win, someone did these statistics, and I don't know how they figured it out, but in order for her to win, supposedly, she has to get 3 out of every 5 absentee ballots. That's 60%, obviously, and that's pretty high. Very rarely does that happen. And since Miller is the more conservative candidate, as said, if that thing skews the traditional way, she will not only lose, but she'll lose worse than she's losing now. One of the things we do, I should tell those of you who have not heard the show before, is every week we do something called News of the Weird. and that's obtained from a website called newsoftheweird.blogspot.com. What that is that's a website that is produced by the same folks who produce that column for a number of newspapers. So you can go to newsoftheweird.blogspot.com, and you can read the things that we are extracting from that site, as well as many others. In some cases, the reason we don't report on things that are on that site is because they don't belong on the radio. Of course, this is Blog Talk Radio, so you can say and do pretty much anything, but we prefer to make our show available to people of all ages, and therefore we maintain pretty much the standards that are on a normal broadcast station, not entirely. In any event, you can go there if you wish to do that. We also have This Day in History, so we'll cover a couple of things there. Let me mention what I was talking about, however, before we get to News of the Weird. At the very, very beginning of the show, I mentioned this is an anniversary, and I said happy anniversary to us. No, it is not my wedding anniversary. but it is the anniversary of this show. Tonight is the 52nd week, with the exception of the fact that 2 weeks we weren't on at all. This is essentially it's a year. It's a year of Thursdays anyway since we started the show. So if you started with us at the beginning and you're still listening to us, thank you very much. And I suggest you have your sanity checked. But if you've joined us in between, thank you again, and we hope you continue to stay with us and join us each week here at the same bat time and bat station. By the way, if you're listening to us live, you can listen to past programs in archive fashion by coming to the same site and just picking a date, either randomly or because the stars were shining in the proper form on that night or whatever, and you can hear any of our past shows. The more interesting part tends to be in the latter half when we interview somebody, but you can listen to all of the shows and see how right or wrong we were about certain things. But that's one thing. Now, if you're listening to us in archive edition, you can listen to us live. We are normally on live Thursday nights at 6:30 Pacific, 9:30 Eastern. That's 6:30 p.m., 9:30 p.m., at least during the part of the year when some parts of the country are on daylight savings time. We change that. We change when we're on in the winter time when we are off daylight savings because the state we're in doesn't follow daylight savings time, and in order for us to be on the same time for our own convenience, it gets screwed up everywhere else. So we'll explain that as we get closer. But for the foreseeable future, we are on from at 6:30 to 7:30 Pacific and 9:30 to 10:30 Eastern time. And as a reminder, in about 7 minutes, we'll be joined. Okay, 6 minutes. The clock just changed. We'll be joined by Larry Hancock, the author of the Kennedy book, and he's also written about Martin Luther King. And I unfortunately have, Larry, if you're listening, I apologize. I have forgotten the name of the book. I know it starts with If, but he'll talk about that and remind us. He and I were having an exchange earlier talking about poor memories, and I'm afraid that he may have won this one. But he'll be joining us, in about 6 minutes. If you want to join us before that, feel free. If you want to join us after he's been with us for a while and you have a question of him or would like to make a comment, you're welcome. And the phone number, again, is 347-994-3796. Now, we'll get to some news of the weird. In some countries in Africa, fat women are considered extremely attractive. Well, here's something that goes along with that. In Mauritania, people are paid $200 to force feed young women to bulk them up if they won't eat on their own. Their parents pay that to have them force fed so that they'll be suitable brides, suitable prospects for someone who wants to get married. Now, I mentioned that we try to keep our program suitable for all ages. The next one may not quite fit into that, so if you want to put your ears in if you want to put your ears in your child's fingers, that's fine, but if you want to put your fingers in your child's ear so she or he doesn't hear this, this would be a good time to do that. This was not, by the way, on the newsoftheweird.blogspot.com site, but something that was in the news a couple of days ago. In Phoenix, a man was arrested for allegedly fondling the sexual organ of another passenger on the city's light rail train. The other passenger was sleeping at the time, and they did arrest this guy who supposedly did it. The story that I read didn't say whether the guy woke up, but that's beside the point. Memo to self, don't fall asleep on the train, ever. Okay. There is a story of a couple of, in different, actually two stories about bad multitaskers, which we'll share from newsoftheweird.com. Brian Parslow, 19, injured himself and three passengers when he crashed into a tree near Wheatland, New York, recently. He was playing Hold Your Breath with his passengers, and he passed out. So don't play Hold Your Breath when you're driving, please. And last month, Laura Hunt, at age 49, was sentenced to 18 months in jail. This is a terrible story, but peculiar as well. Because she crashed with a woman on a motorcycle in Lake County, Illinois, and the woman on the motorcycle was killed. This was back in 2009, but she was sentenced last month. It turns out she was preoccupied while she was driving, painting her nails. After the collision, nail polish was splashed all over the interior of the car. And she was so preoccupied that she never even applied the brakes before the collision. Okay, this day in history, I know you're going to be fascinated with this. In 1847, on August 26th, Liberia was declared independent. Does anyone know why Liberia was formed and by whom? And what about who its capital was named after? Anyone? Okay. The answer is, in 1847, Liberia was formed in Africa by freed American slaves. They weren't freed because of the Civil War. They were freed for other reasons. There were a number of reasons why slaves gained their freedom. And in the United States, that meant that they were free to be discriminated against. But in any event, they... there were free blacks in the United States, and these folks went to Liberia, or to this portion of Africa, and formed a country, and they created it so that they could have a place that was in fact theirs, and was going to be free of discrimination, obviously, against African Americans. Now they were African American Africans. But anyway, the capital of Monrovia was named after James Monroe. I have no idea why, by the way, but that's what that was. On this date in 1920, which is 90 years ago, the 19th Amendment to the U.S. Constitution went into effect. Anyone remember what the 19th Amendment is? Okay, that's the one that gave women the right to vote in this country. That only took effect 90 years. 1920, if you think about that, that's really odd. First off, most countries had already given women the right to vote. You know, that is, most democracies. And there weren't a lot of them in 1920, but those that were around had already given women the right to vote, by and large. We were late in the game. But 1920 was, I'd have to sit and figure it out, but it, almost 200 years. Oh, no, it wasn't. It was about 170 years, I guess. This country really got going in the late 1780s. The early 1780s. So that would be like 140 years it took to get women the vote. Unbelievable. In 1978, Pope John Paul I took over that post. You may recall he died a month later, and the next pope was Pope John Paul II, who served for obviously a number of years. And tomorrow, which is August 27th, is the anniversary of the Kellogg-Briand Treaty. In 1928, it outlawed war, and it worked so very well. The day after tomorrow is more significant, the day after tomorrow was August 28th. The day after tomorrow will be August 28th. In 1963, on August 28th, Dr. Martin Luther King at the Lincoln Memorial gave his famous speech, which included the phrase, "I have a dream." That's significant for all kinds of reasons, not least of which is that on August 28th, 2010, that brilliant intellect and fine human being, Glenn Beck, at the Lincoln Memorial, is having a rally, essentially an anti-Obama rally. And he claims that he chose the date coincidentally. He had no idea that was the date that Dr. King gave a speech at the Lincoln Memorial. I believe him. Don't you? Okay. Now, if I hit the right button, and I'm guessing right, we have the one and only Larry Hancock with us. Larry, are you there?
Good evening, Jeff.
Hi, how are you?
I'm doing fine, thank you.
Good. Welcome to you from Oklahoma.
It's a little cooler than it has been for the last couple of weeks where it was like routinely 105 degrees.
I don't know if you're aware of it, but you almost said the last couple of years. It seemed like the last couple of years, right?
It felt like that. Yes, it did.
Okay, so what kind of temperatures are you having now?
Oh, we're down. Actually, we're in the 90s. We were in the 80s a couple of days ago, so this is wonderful weather.
That's great. Larry, as you may have heard if you were listening, I actually, and I have my notes in front of me and everything, and I forgot the name of your book. I know what it is. Someone Would Have Talked.
Someone Would Have Talked.
Right? Okay. For those of you who have listened to the show enough, you've heard Larry on the show. I don't know how many times you've been on, probably four or five.
Right.
In our 52 weeks. And he is returning now in part because the third edition?
The third edition, yes.
Someone Would Have Talked is coming out. And when is that due out?
I'm going through the final author's review copy right now, so I think we're close enough to feel comfortable that it should make it in September.
Okay. And when it makes it in September, which is just obviously next month, if someone wants to read this book, as they will, after we have this discussion, if they haven't already looked for it, they can do that by going to your website, which is?
www.larry-hancock.com.
There you go. Or?
Or they can get it through Amazon.
Okay, there you go. I'm helping you with shameless self-promotion.
I appreciate that. I can stand shameless self-promotion.
Mm-hmm. Okay, very good.
I used to be in marketing, though.
Okay. Well, I'm in sales, so, you know, I completely relate. In any event, and the event is the coming publication of the third edition of Someone Would Have Talked, tell us what the reason is for the, well, first off, let us explain. Larry's book is about the assassination of John Fitzgerald Kennedy, the 35th president of the United States, who was president, for those of you who are too young to have lived through it and did not get a particularly good education. He was president from January 20th, 1961 until November 22nd, 1963, when he was assassinated by, well, that's not altogether clear, is it? So Larry's book is about that, and Larry, tell us what's going to be new in the third. This is not just about promoting the book. This is about newly discovered information about the Kennedy assassination. So tell us, generally speaking, what's new in the third edition.
Well, and I think kind of to set the stage for that, it has to do with why there would be anything new. I mean, it's been over 45 years. Why could there be something new at this point in time? And and I think many people don't realize. I talked to two groups of people. One who think that all of the records relating to JFK have yet to be released and may happen, you know, that may happen somewhere down the road. And they think that because they weren't released for decades. You know, they were kept restricted.
Right.
And so they think that that's going to happen and hasn't yet. But that really is not true because of what happened in the 1990s with the movie JFK and the JFK Records Act and the Assassinations Record Review Board actually did release millions of pages of documents late in the 90s, and the work of the Assassinations Records Review Board was extensive in getting further records released, doing oral history interviews with lots of people. There were extensive interviews with remaining people from the medical staff who did the autopsy. So we've had a ton of information come into our hands even since 2000, because obviously if you release millions of pages of records, it takes a couple of days to go through them.
Well, I was just going to ask you, isn't it true that when you release all those records and that large volume of records, it is in some ways a disadvantage to researchers?
Oh, it is, and especially, well, actually, we had to cope with the fact that when they released them, just as because of the way it was handled, they were mm-hmm. released, and they weren't released as a separate collection. They were put into the same groups of filing boxes that had already been there, so you really, you couldn't go to the National Archives and have them point you over into corner to, you know, 500 boxes and go, well, that's the new stuff, have fun. You had to go back into the old collections and find the new stuff. So that's a massive challenge for researchers.
Mm-hmm.
I think two things have really helped us along those parts. One is that there's been a huge amount of work putting those documents online. And we've talked about, for example, the Mary Farrell website before, which has million pages of documents, actually well over a million pages, where you can actually do a database search and you can do data mining, which is a lot faster than going to the National Archives and doing it page by page. And so that's really given us a leg up, and that's only been available for a very few years now. It's kind of amazing what we can do now. But I do think, just to kind of close that out, it's kind of interesting because one of the senior people on the Records Review Board did an interview just, you know, when they had done their final release and went to the reporters and said, well, we've released all the records and we didn't find any smoking guns. And all of us went, yeah, but we haven't looked at them yet. You just released them.
Right.
We need to look at them.
Well, I think in part what he was acknowledging was what you were saying, not just that you guys hadn't, you know, the researchers hadn't looked at it, but that the board itself hadn't looked at it. They would just, you know, massively release records, right?
That's right, absolutely. And some of the board staff, of course, some of the staff members did get to look at documents as they were going through and actually trying to acquire them from people. But, again, in many cases, they just got batches and files and that sort of thing. So no one really had examined them in any depth at that time. But I think it just shows sometimes people are really eager to please the press.
Yeah. Now, in the meantime, let me ask you this. Is it correct to assume, and that's what it is because I don't know the answer, that even at this late stage, the records that were released have not been fully analyzed?
No, we have not gone through all of the records yet. I think that's very safe to say. We've not gone through all of the records, and we're still fighting for certain records that we know exist, but which the various agencies have yet to release. One battle that's going on right now is it's only been in recent years that certain researchers realized that there were a key set of CIA documents pertaining to the organization that Lee Oswald was trying to associate himself with in New Orleans in 1963. And we know those documents exist, but even it's been over 2 years now in a court battle to get the documents, mm-hmm. and the CIA still won't release them, which
now
makes you begin to
ask. The organization
you
I'm sorry.
These are private individuals, groups, including lawyers in Washington, D.C., who fight for release of documents.
Right.
Jefferson Morley is probably the lead person.
Well, okay, the reason this question I was actually going to ask you, and I apologize for interrupting you, but the question I was actually going to ask you was the group with which Oswald was supposedly associated, I assume you're referring to the Fair Play for Cuba Committee.
No, actually, this would be the DRE. This was the Cuban Exile Student Group, who was very active both politically and militarily, and Oswald mm-hmm. was actually trying to, it appeared on the surface that he was trying to infiltrate that group in New Orleans. And mm-hmm. so we would expect that we would find a lot of communications between their people in New Orleans and their CIA case officer about what this strange Marine was trying to do. And so there should have been quite a bit of, look, they were very sensitive to people who were trying to join up with the organization.
Sure.
Oswald had offered to help train them, and then mm-hmm. they had an encounter with Oswald where he was passing out pro-Castro leaflets, gotten into a street fight, got on, and in the event, it was quite a big affair publicity-wise, so we'd expect there would be a lot in the files about that. And the files are still restricted after all of these years for no very good reason, except one might speculate that possibly the CIA knew more about Lee Oswald than they told the Warren Commission.
What a shock that would be.
That would be a major shock, wouldn't it?
Yeah. So tell us now about some of the stuff that has been uncovered. One of the things that you had mentioned, and if you want to go in a different direction, that's fine, but one of the things you mentioned was a kind of intervention by the late Congressman Hale Boggs of Louisiana.
Yes, one of the things we're finding, when you get a collection of records like this, really it goes much further than just the assassination itself. Some people would think, well, you're probably just getting records from 1963 and 1964. But that's not true, because the House Select Committee on Assassinations, which worked in the 1970s, collected records from all through that period, including you know, their own records. So, interestingly, we see a lot of records and documents from the 1967 era, the Garrison investigation in New Orleans. And we're seeing a lot of that. We're seeing a lot of transcripts of conversation. One fascinating transcript is a transcript of a phone call with President Johnson at that time, where the Attorney General is warning President Johnson that there are rumors circulating that there's an investigation going on, and they have found evidence that he was involved in the assassination.
He being Lyndon Johnson.
Yes.
And the Attorney General at that time, prior to this period, the Attorney General of the United States had been from 61 until sometime, I don't know, I think it was probably 1964, had been Bobby Kennedy.
Right.
At this period, the Attorney General would have been Nick Katzenbach.
Nick Katzenbach, yes. And
okay.
Johnson received an interesting similar call from Governor Connally, who was passing along
Governor
the same
Texas,
rumors
right.
to him. Yes, so it's rather fascinating. And perhaps the most fascinating thing about the exchange, for those of you who are familiar with Lyndon Johnson, Johnson didn't make any reply to the remarks, which would probably be the only time in history that Johnson didn't make a reply, and even a profane reply.
Well, and one of the reasons I would assume that he, and none of us will really know, but one of the reasons that he presumably would not have made a comment is because he was the one in those conversations who knew it was being recorded.
That's true. We would assume that he knew it was being recorded, but considering his response, you know, one would expect it would not have been unusual to sign just, you know, some sort of exclamation like, who in the world would think
sure.
that, you know?
Yeah.
It just doesn't say anything at all.
Yeah, or you know, son, that's a lot of crap. You know,
yeah,
something like
exactly.
That. Or something much worse that we, you know, wouldn't say here, but yeah.
It's fair to say that he didn't show any restraint even when he knew he was being recorded.
Yeah, as a rule, that's right. Yeah, and he knew he was being recorded. He knew about the recording system in the White House, obviously.
Yes, he did.
And okay, so you got that. Now, how was Hale Boggs involved?
Hale Boggs, actually, as it turns out, was one of those people who had an early conversation with District Attorney Garrison, and Garrison was kind of feeling out people about doing an investigation and whether or not there was still any skepticism. You know, it basically was everybody buying into the official line? And it's pretty clear that Boggs told him not only did he not believe the official story, but certainly there were people on the Warren Commission who had not been entirely convinced either.
Right. Hale Boggs, as a couple of side notes here, Hale Boggs was a congressman from Louisiana who later died in a plane crash. His wife, widow, took over his congressional seats, and their daughter is someone that many of you have heard of, Cokie Roberts, an ABC News correspondent. I didn't know if you knew that.
No, I did not.
Okay, well, there you go. And her brother and their son is a rather well-known lobbyist in D.C. I don't remember his first name, but his last name is obviously Boggs, And Cokie Roberts is Roberts because she married another journalist whose last name is Roberts. Enough for the trivia now. Go ahead.
But so we're learning, I think, Jeff, that we're learning a lot about how matters were handled internally in the mm-hmm. various groups. It's fascinating now to go back and see some of the internal transcripts of the Warren Commission where they go off the record. I mean, it's almost frightening to see a remark made to the order of, we shouldn't be discussing this for the record. We need to stop recording this. Or, you know, you people are nuts. We shouldn't even be talking about this subject. Or, you know, Hoover is not going to tell us the truth about anything, and there's no way that we're going to be able to find out for ourselves. It's just sort of amazing to see that or to hear that dialogue or see the transcripts. And then you go back at some of the pictures of the Warren Commission handing over the report to President Johnson, and they're all smiling
right.
and self-confident, and you're going, no, I know what you guys really said.
It's a whitewash. But, you know, I think that was the title of one of the assassination books.
Yes,
but,
it was.
Okay, what you're saying, and I didn't know this before, is that, number one, they kept a transcript when they went off record, and number two, they were saying that there are certain things they should not be saying, either on a record or even talking at all while a transcript was being made.
Correct.
Wow.
And so you can see that. You can, and we're seeing it in other places, too. There's the Assassinations Record Review Board did a fine job of coming up with information, this sort of information, background, contextual information. And I looked at a document recently, and in the document, the Secret Service was investigating the apparent disappearance of certain things from the autopsy, certain
mm-hmm.
pieces of evidence, certain reports, certain documents. And so, you know, this is after the assassination. This is, everything's been settled, but they're doing their job trying to find out what happened to this evidence. And there's an exchange of memos, and one of the board staff members, Doug Horn, documents all of this. But you get to a
By staff member, you're referring to a staff member of the Warren Commission?
No, the Assassinations Records Review Board.
Okay,
the
go
ARB.
Ahead. Mm-hmm.
And so they get to a certain point in time, and then you see this memo, and the memo says, well, it appears that it wouldn't be a good idea if we pursued this any further.
Wow.
And you go, what? You know, this is the Secret Service, and they're trying to find out what's happened to certain medical evidence, and they've decided that it would be inappropriate, politically sensitive. What? What is going on here?
Yeah, somebody obviously stopped them or told them, hey, you don't want to go there, and it was, in all likelihood, of course, the FBI or the CIA.
But we see questions all over the place like that, that things
mm-hmm.
get to a certain point, and they just stop. And I think that's one of the things we've learned. And you'd ask me what's new in the book, and I think one of the areas, major area of addition in the book, is we've really expanded on the analysis of what followed the assassination immediately, the first
mm-hmm.
72 hours, the first week, what was going on, and basically to address the question of why we don't know things. Because there are
mm-hmm.
a ton of things that we should know that shouldn't be mysterious. It
right.
really shouldn't
like.
Be. Well, I'll give you an example. When the Assassinations Records Review Board called in a couple of the autopsy doctors, and this is in the late 90s,
mm-hmm.
and they said, well, you know, we'd just like to run through the documents that are available. We found some things that appear to be missing, and we want to make sure that we have all the records that are possible. So we're going to show you the photos. You know, this is the official record of your autopsy. We're going to show the photos and x-rays. And we would just like you to point out to us, you know, clearly where the wounds are that, you know, show us what you based your report on.
Mm-hmm.
And they go through hours of dialogue, and the doctors can't do it. And the doctors.
Did it sound like the doctors were trying to cover up at that late point, or are they saying, no, this, you know, or did they explain why it was that it didn't connect?
they don't really, not only do they not really explain it, they make comments like, well, I know we took a picture of that, but you don't seem to have it. Or, well, why don't you just bring over that X-ray? Well, it's not in the file. Oh, well, but, so, you know, they sound puzzled to some extent, but then on the other mm-hmm. hand, one of the concluding remarks by one of the doctors was, well, I hope you guys figure it out.
Wow.
And that sort of leaves you nonplussed. You know, like, you did the autopsy on the, and, you know, aren't you concerned? I mean, this is probably the most important thing you did in your life, and we don't even have a picture that shows us the wounds, and, like, it's our problem?
Yeah. And the let me ask you a question, and I understand you may not know this, but is the normal course in an autopsy, I suppose it would be different for a president anyway, but is the normal course in an autopsy that in addition to the scientific analysis that they also in fact take pictures, take photographs?
Oh, they absolutely do take pictures. And you've got to remember that is evidence in a criminal investigation.
That's right. Okay.
I can't think of any prosecutor who's going to want to walk into court if he can't clearly show photos with a wound circled, you know, and
sure.
a tag on it and a marker, and, you know, that's just standard procedure. And actually,
okay.
you know, the researchers interviewed people that do that routinely, and certainly there's a protocol and a best practice for that. And
mm-hmm.
none of that is an appearance in this. So either they didn't do it and did a horrendously sloppy job of recording the assassination of the autopsy of the president, or there's something wrong with the record.
Right.
Go ahead.
I was just going to say, and one has to believe that once he was pronounced dead, the folks who were doing the autopsy knew that this in essence was going to be the most important autopsy they ever did, in all likelihood. You would think that they would not be sloppy, and with all the people who were in there, you would think that even if one or two people, you know, were not all that diligent and careful, somebody else would have, you know, come into play and say, hey, guys, we got to do it this way.
And they did have, one of the doctors was, Dr. Fink, was certainly quite experienced. The other two weren't, but, I mean, and
mm-hmm.
these are also teaching doctors who teach
right.
people how to do these things. So mm-hmm. Certainly that's true. And at that time, you have to remember, Lee Oswald was alive. You know, there was going to be a trial. This is not this is not over and done. There's going to be a trial, so this is just the
important.
Very first stage of the process.
Yeah. We didn't explain because we assumed everybody would know who the gentleman was. So let me throw in an explanation here, and then I want to ask you about somebody else. The Jim Garrison investigation that was mentioned by Larry. Jim Garrison was the district attorney for Orleans Parish, where Lee Harvey Oswald had been, where Jack Ruby was, where a number of other people who are alleged to, or pretty clearly were involved in the conspiracy to kill the president, had hatched some of their plans. And that's what Garrison was investigating. Garrison later became a judge. He passed away a number of years ago. But I wanted to ask you about J.D. Tippit. And just first off, J.D. Tippit, from everything everybody already knows who followed the news, who lived through it or read any of the history, was an officer who was supposedly killed by Lee Harvey Oswald after the assassination. But tell us more about J.D.
Well, there certainly are a lot of mysteries about there are lots of loose ends about that shooting. Some of them are the same sorts of loose ends that we find in the Kennedy shooting, and you have the bullets from the Tippit shooting, and there's no legitimate chain of possession on them. You can't trace the holes that were found at the scene through to what's in evidence now. There are issues like that, but there are issues of how Tippit got to where he even encountered Oswald, why he would have been on that street, what would have caused that encounter to happen. There are reports of other people there, witnesses who saw other people at the time. A lot of conflict in witness testimony about the shooting of Officer Tippit. One witness is very adamant that the person who shot him didn't just shoot him. For example, you know, a scenario, a logical scenario
mm-hmm.
might be that Officer Tippit had seen something suspicious, stopped Lee Oswald. Whatever Oswald said to him didn't satisfy him. Tippit gets out of the car. Well, that's logical enough, but one witness says that actually the person who shot him came around at the front of the police car, shot the officer, and when the officer was on the ground, continued to shoot the officer.
Right.
You know, didn't run away, literally continued to shoot him until he was quite dead, which is...
I would say extremely dead, yeah.
Yeah, which is, you know, doesn't make much sense for a fleeing presidential assassin as to why would you would have to stand there and shoot the policeman multiple times until he was dead. That's strange. One of the more fascinating mysteries, and one of the things that I introduce in the book, at least, is though, we've recently come to realize, and this one's been around for a while, but I don't think we realized how mysterious it really was. Jeff, you probably heard that there were, at the time that Oswald was leaving the scene of the crime, there were also a number of people that saw a person run away from the school book depository, get into a station wagon out front and drive away.
I have not heard that.
Okay, yeah, this is true. A police officer reported it, and at least three other witnesses reported somebody clearly did run down the front of the knoll in front of the school book depository and flag down a car and get in it and go away, which is really strange to happen at that point in time. The person is reported looking very similar to Oswald, and there's actually a photo that shows a person that looks pretty similar to Oswald. Now, that's not the way Oswald supposedly left. Lee Oswald supposedly left by bus and taxi, you know. But there is a report of, you know, someone looking like Oswald in a car leaving the scene. Well, you bring up J.D. Tippit. Right after the assassination, a policeman who had been working off-duty, he was off-duty policeman that way, he had been working in a car shop. It just so happens the car shop was in the same parking lot as a Mexican restaurant. The Mexican restaurant was the location where the cab dropped off Lee Oswald, about three blocks away from his apartment house. The policeman saw two men in station wagon or in a car there, thought they were very suspicious, went over and took down the license plate of the car because as soon as they saw the policeman, they gunned it and raced off. But he got their license plate. When they went to check out the license plate was registered and the car was, you know, this car is legitimate. They go to talk to the owner of the car and he's not there, and they ask his wife, well, you know, where is he? We need to talk with him, and what's he been doing today? Because his car was reported. She said, well, he left very early this morning to go visit his good friend, Officer Tippit.
And this was already after Tippit was dead.
Yes.
They heard this.
And that's the sort of thing that makes you shake your head. Kind of like, wait a minute. Car scene where Oswald was dropped off from the cab, somebody that looks like Oswald, very mysterious, and the guy who owned the car was visiting Officer Tippit the first thing. You know, obviously there are coincidences, but then sometimes they push the numbers a little bit much, and we still don't understand that. The police never really investigated it in detail. Some local news people got into it, but by that time Oswald was dead, and you know the official story was pretty well set. But there's still no explanation as to why that car
was there at all.
Was there at all, and what that would have had to do with Officer Tippit very early in the morning that he got killed.
Yeah, considerably strange. And with the guy who looked like Oswald, but apparently wasn't, because Oswald was no longer at that location, according to all the stories, right?
But we have several very solid indications of Oswald being impersonated. I don't know if we've discussed this, but there was actually a very credible report of a man who picked up a hitchhiker 2 days before the assassination, drove him downtown, dropped him off by the school book depository. The hitchhiker had a package with him which contained a rifle. And he was talking about the president's visit and wondering if anyone would shoot the president. And this story, this fellow actually told the story to his coworkers before the assassination, and it was verified by polygraph after the assassination.
And but this guy who he saw was not the guy
was
who
not
he
Lee Oswald.
Saw on TV as Oswald. Yeah.
Right. So Oswald, I mean, there was somebody going around Dallas that looked a lot like Oswald impersonating him and setting him up.
Yeah, that's obviously what was occurring. As a matter of fact, I assume you know this, I remember it was either a magazine article or a book that was called The Two Oswalds.
Mm-hmm.
And this goes way, way back.
Yes. That has probably to do more with Oswald's return from Russia, but...
It also had to do with the fact that there was another man who looked a good deal like him but was not him. Yeah.
And this, we encountered this in several places before the assassination. Someone who looked a lot like Oswald used the name Oswald.
Yeah.
Didn't know. Well, and I don't know if we discussed the fact that the morning after the assassination, in another call, J. Edgar Hoover told President Johnson that someone had been impersonating Lee Oswald in Mexico City before the assassination.
Call that. Mm-hmm.
And Johnson's response, you'll never guess what Johnson's response was.
Silence?
Yes, you got it.
Jeez, that's amazing. Now, this report Hoover gave to Johnson was when?
This was the morning after the assassination.
Wow. Amazing. Well, first off, we've got about 3 minutes left, and hard to believe, right? And so it's probably too late for anybody who wishes to call now, but Larry has agreed to join us again next week. We had a cancellation of a scheduled guest, so Larry's going to join, which was fortunate because obviously we've scratched the surface again with some of this new stuff, and want to talk next week, among other things, about Ruth Payne. And several of the other things that you have, I hesitate to assign to you discovery, but at least have gone through and researched and or have put into the book. So if you want to join us next week, please keep in mind same time and station. Well, not station, it's blogtalkradio.com/Jeff-Bushman. And I have to assume that anyone who's hearing that this already knows that. But if you want to make plans to join us next week on the phone as well, it's 347-994-3796. If it sounds like I'm hurrying, I am, because we've got less than 2 minutes, I believe. Also, if you want to take a look at Larry's work and see some of what he's been talking about, it's Larry-Hancock, H-A-N-C-O-C-K, .com. And you can also put in Larry Hancock in the Amazon search box, and you will find him as well. Any other promotion for you that I didn't do?
No, I appreciate it. I think in 1 minute I can wrap up one thing we talked about, though.
Please go ahead.
And that's the autopsy and the reason why the evidence seems to be lacking. From what we know now, and I do discuss this in the new edition, it looks like the doctors had to actually revise their autopsy report several times over about 72 hours as new information kept coming in. The problem was, of course, the body was gone by about 3 a.m. that morning. So as they had to keep revising their autopsy conclusions, they couldn't take any more pictures and they couldn't take any more x-rays.
Right.
So they were essentially stuck because the first scenario that they had documented wasn't going to work.
Amazing. All right, well... Yeah, the whole thing at Parkland was amazing. And we'll talk more about that next week. We have exactly a minute left. And so thank everybody for joining us. Tell your friends, tell your enemies, tell everybody to join us next week. Larry will be returning, and we'll cover a good deal more of the material that is in his third edition. And your calls will also be invited. Larry, thanks again. And I'll talk to you I'll talk to you on air next week.
Thank you, sir. Next week.
All right, amigo. A deal. Bye-bye. And thank all of you. Thank our magnificent producer, Autumn Bushman, who has left the BBC, the Bushman Broadcast Center. So, again, thank you again. Join us next week. Do tell your friends, because in addition to the fact that obviously we'd like more people listening, more importantly, what Larry's talking about, I expect will be interesting to many of them. So from the West Coast to the East Coast to the North and the South, thank you. Good night. Have a great week, and we'll see you here.